up.
Okay.
And just start by saying that this is David Klein. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and it is May the 17th today,
correct?
2006, and making this recording for the Southern Oral History Program's Long Civil Rights Movement Project. And if you could just introduce yourself and say
yes.
Hello.
My name is Melvin Bethel, and I live in Louisville, 4436 Lockwood Avenue, and I'm currently retired, and I'm president of the Yearlings Club, which is a men's social and civic organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you did not grow up in Louisville yourself?
No, I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia. Came out to Kentucky to go to school at Kentucky State.
Mm-hmm.
Graduated from Kentucky State, got drafted in the Army, was in the Army during the Vietnam era, spent 13 months overseas in Paris, France,
mm-hmm.
and returned in Louisville in 1967, and I've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And did you go to work right away in 67?
Yes. My first job here was with Camp Atterbury Job Corps Center, which is in Edinburgh, Indiana. And I taught 2 years up there, teaching, I guess you might say, dropouts from public schools. And basically, they were sent there. They had three choices, the military, prison, or the Job Corps. And a lot of them chose the Job Corps. Most of them were below their grade level in reading and math and social studies. So primarily, I taught from a programmed type of situation. And I stayed there 2 years, and then I came back and worked at Park Duval Community Social Service Center.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell me about that program?
That program basically was providing assistance to people who were impoverished, who were having problems just living on a day-to-day basis, needing assistance with rent, food, clothing, because we had a clothing pantry, and medical assistance. Under the poverty program, we had a budget to provide assistance, and we were governed by a board made of low-income residents from the neighborhood, and they set the policy other than what was set in federal policy in terms of how we should assist residents of the area, how often they could receive assistance, and the amount of assistance that they could receive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did they see you as an outsider because you weren't from that neighborhood, or was it?
No, primarily, I was supervisor, the intake supervisor, because at that time I was one of the few employees besides my supervisor who had a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so my contact with the residents was minimal, okay? So, the staff that I had, which was made up of 19 women and one male,
okay,
were all older than me, maybe except three employees. And so therefore, they knew, the employees knew the people in the community. And at first I encountered some resistance when I first took the job, but I sort of won them over with my personality and the role and job that we were going to play. and helping the people in the neighborhood. And so it wasn't long after that that, you know, we began to mesh as a unit. Mm-hmm. Right.
And what were, when you first got there, what really were the most pressing needs?
The most pressing needs in that community at that particular time had to do with providing assistance for rent, as well as providing assistance for food. Mm-hmm. And though a lot of them were getting food stamps, they still needed assistance. Mm-hmm. Could we stop for one
sure,
minute?
Sure, after
mm-hmm. Ready to go. Mm-hmm.
Great. So the you were saying that really it was rent and food.
Right, rent and food were two of the most pressing needs. And because adjacent to the service center was a health center.
Right.
And so the health center was stocked with doctors and dentists and nurses, and they provided all of the healthcare mm-hmm. services. We basically provided the social services. Most were on some form of public assistance, okay? So most did not work.
Right.
And in our building, there was a job training mm-hmm. Program. But when you know you're on public assistance and you have small children, it's difficult for you to work, even though some of them took classes to try to either get a GED or to try to take courses that would prepare them to go in the world of work.
Right.
Because most of them had never worked or had never held a job. They had probably come right out of high school, gotten pregnant, had children, receiving public assistance, no man in the house. So it was very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so we were basically providing assistance in terms of rent and assistance in terms of food. Mm-hmm. Okay, so those were the two pressing needs
right.
that they had.
Right. Mm-hmm. And can you just sort of describe the Parc Duval area?
The Parc Duval area at that particular time was probably made up of 95% black or African American, probably 60% female head of household. Mm-hmm. Poverty level probably 80% in poverty, with maybe only 15 to 20% working mothers or father and mother, and a very dismal
right.
situation. It was made up primarily of two public housing projects. One was named Carter Homes, to the east, and to the west was Southwick. Southwick being the larger, and it escapes me now, but I don't remember how many families, but it was quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
Those that were legitimately enrolled in public housing and those who were living with,
mm-hmm.
okay? But if you get an opportunity and go by there now, you would see that it's changed
yeah,
completely.
Yeah, I was there
yesterday. Were you?
Yeah.
Well, and it had to change.
Tell me how it's changed.
Well, it has changed in that, one, they relocated all of the residents. Good for those residents, not good for these residents. because they came to these neighborhoods, to our neighborhood. And they were not prepared to live in a in the average neighborhood. They
were people who were displaced.
Displaced, who were relocated.
Yeah,
right.
Ended up
right, in our neighborhoods. And we've seen an increase in crime, increase in robbery, increase in violence, increase in black on black crime, youth killing each other. And we've also seen an increase in the community being dirty with paper, just dirty, you know, from people not having to had do that before, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're in the larger community and they don't do it. So you see paper trash and stuff all over, you know, especially Broadway where you were.
Right.
That used to be the beautifulest place there was, but there were apartments on Broadway that I never knew existed prior to them relocating people from Park Duval and Southwick. And I never knew they existed because the people who occupied them prior to those relocatees lived in them as if they were their own personal homes. Okay, you didn't see the papers, you didn't see the trash, they cut the grass, people didn't hang out on the steps. You didn't see the doors open all the time, especially in the winter, you know. It changed the landscape, and the people in these neighborhoods where they relocated them began to complain to city officials that the next time you do this, you know, you need to prepare those people to live in the larger community. Because if you know anything about public housing, it's basically their own little city, so to speak. And while law officials may go into those projects, it's usually for a domestic dispute or a shooting or something like that, but basically they set their own rules and do their own thing because they are enclosed community. So it has changed for the good of that neighborhood because now they have new single family housing, they have new apartments, they have senior citizen housing, they have a health center, and it appears to be well managed. And I think what happened with public housing, because my background is in housing, is that it was management, and management got a little too lax, and so therefore, I think the residents just controlled what was, you know, public housing. And people, a lot of people lived in public housing in fear. And so what happened was those same people who were notorious in the sense and living them, when they came to the larger community, they tried to do the same thing, push their weight around in terms of the kind of behavior that they had exhibited, you know, in public housing. But what you will find out is that it has caused a lot of problems for the larger community. If you just go back and do some research, you'll see that right after they began to relocate the people from Park Duval and Southwick, you saw a lot of killings, murders, shootings, car thefts, break-ins on in areas of River Park, 38th, 39th, 40th, 41st, Broadway, Cecil, places where there were vacant structures,
right,
and where they relocated them. And it got really, really bad. And people were beginning to question, you know, why so many murders, why so much violence, but it was basically the people who had been relocated.
You said your own background is in housing?
Yes. I work for U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development from 1970 until 92. Oh,
okay.
Okay. So. And then I worked with Catholic Charities, their Immigration and Migration Division for a year and a half, directing the English as a Second Language school.
Okay.
Okay. And then I went back and worked with, well, not back, I went back into housing, and I worked for Louisville Metro Housing Department. And I did that for 9 years. And now I'm retired.
So you went from your, so how long were you with the War on Poverty program then?
Well, I was with them for 2 years.
Okay.
For 2 years, and then I went to graduate school at the Kent School of Social Work, mm-hmm. and got my master's in MSSW, Master of Science in Social Work, 62 hours. Now you can do it in 30, but it was 62 hours. You had to go 2 years, couldn't hold a job. They found you a job in the summer. You worked at a placement after 3, but basically it was 2 years of classroom work and field work. Mm-hmm. So I did that after I left the War on Poverty. I was there 2 years from 68, I think, to 70. Mm-hmm. And
now, had you always wanted to do that kind of work, or?
Well, I did, and that was, and I thought I would remain doing that kind of work. That's why I went into social work, because I saw that need. But fortunately, while I was working a placement in a building, a friend of mine that I met that was also from Virginia got a job with HUD. And so he was looking for somebody, and he knew me, and he asked me, would I come and, you know, work with him? And so I did. Mm-hmm. And but in housing, you know, I was doing some similar things, you know, because I was working with the population in public housing.
Right.
Okay.
Sure.
And I was working with populations that was getting subsidized housing, so I handled complaints.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I investigated complaints.
Okay.
and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But it was just one of those things. I worked. I never really did what you would consider social work again, like I had done at Park Duval.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed those 2 years that I was there. Because of some of the real good contacts I made and the people that I worked with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before the War on Poverty programs came to Duval,
mm-hmm.
what was being done in that area as far as providing services or organizing people?
You know, before it came, David, I really don't know, but I had the feeling that nothing was being done, and that was primarily the reason that that area was targeted, because of the high incident, high rate of poverty, unemployment, and they also had a high rate of alcoholism too. So I think because of that particular high incidence of poverty statistics, that area was chosen. But I don't know exactly what was being done prior to my moving, you know, into that arena. And I would caution to say that probably not a whole lot. Not a whole lot, because in the office where I was working, they had also placed a food stamp office, because prior to that, all of the residents had to go downtown.
Right.
When they put an office there, then they could just walk over there, which made it convenient. So I don't think much was being done. Mm. So the area to me was really bad prior to that, but because we had social workers and we worked to work out a plan to help people, you could see things getting better. Mm-hmm. And we were assisting a lot of the residents and helping them get a job. Mm-hmm. And some were successful. Not a whole lot, but you know, some were, because a lot of them had not graduated from high school, mm-hmm. nor did they have their GED. And if you know, or if you're old enough to know about 67, 8, 69, wasn't a whole lot of fast food mm-hmm. Places around at that time. So, you know, you couldn't do like you can today, send a person to fast food. Most was manufacturing, you know, GE, International Harvester, Ford, you know, different places
right.
like that.
Right.
So, and some were able to go to GE, and some were able to go to Ford, and different places like that, because we often got requests for people to come, mm-hmm. and that they were needing workers. So we were able to assist some in that way.
Right, in terms of job placement.
Right, job placement, mm-hmm.
Now, you said the staff was 19 women and one
male.
Man.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the organizers, or that was the entire staff?
That was the entire staff for the social service department.
Right.
Okay, they had the social services. They had the, in that building, they had food stamp office, social services, state unemployment office. They had an office in there. And we would often send people down the hall to counsel with them to see if something was available. And let me see, there was another program for young males that had dropped out. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a job training program for them. And also to work with them to get their GED.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very successful program, because quite a few of them got their GED, and quite a few of them went on to work in jobs at Ford, at GE, and places like that.
Right. So it sounds like education was always a,
right.
a part of that.
Yes,
yeah.
It is. And Dave, the thing that was really funny to me was that when I applied for the job, the staff was already in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy that hired me told me that that I had to supervise these 19 women and this one male. And they said, he said that then the women are older than you, and at first they're not going to listen to them, so listen to you. So somehow you're going to have to. Yeah, right. Yeah. but even as I took rein and had been there for a year, it was almost like they listened, but they didn't listen, because they knew the residents.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, "Mr. Bethel, this person really needs some food." And I said, "But we helped them out 2 months ago. You know, our budget is getting, but Mr. Best, you just don't understand. They ain't got nothing in the refrigerator, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, I just can't see it. You know, I'm looking at this budget and we just don't, you know, well, they're going to do it anyway. You know what I mean? And 2 or 3 days I asked them what happened. Well, Mr. Best, you know, I couldn't let them those children starve and blah, blah. But unlike a lot of programs that were hit with fraud and all, we never had that problem. And primarily because we ran a very tight ship in terms of the budget, but also any food or clothing or whatever was dispensed, none of our workers took it for themselves. Mm-hmm. They distributed it to the people who really needed it. And that was one of the reasons that I really enjoyed working there, because I never had to worry about any of that. Mm-hmm. And we had vouchers at different stores that they could go and get stuff. But whenever they did that, you know, they give me a report and show me a copy of it. And so I was satisfied with that.
Who was your supervisor there?
His name was Sterling Neal.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you worked there. Okay, I met with him yesterday.
Did you? Okay, right. Yeah, okay. Right. Well, he was sort of like a mentor to mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sterling is probably a genius in terms of his memory. He has several degrees. He has a degree in public health from the University of Chicago. He has an MBA and a law degree from Indiana. He studied a PhD at Michigan. And the only reason he didn't get it was because his family was here. And he came back and you know, Michigan is quite a ways from here, and once you come back, you know, and he got caught up in some other things here, and he just stayed here. But when he did, but when he left, and the next time he went to IU, he took his whole family mm-hmm. and educated all of them, his two daughters, his son, and his wife. So. And himself,
right.
Yeah, right, which is really, you know, but him and I go way back because we were at Kentucky State together,
okay. Right.
And that's where we knew each other, that's where I first met him, and you know, and while we were friends, we didn't socialize a lot because he was married and I wasn't, but he knew of me and knew what I had been doing, teaching up at Attleboro, and he felt that, you know, having worked with those young men, I could come and work in this program, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, I applied for the job and got it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was very concerned about drugs at that time. Right,
right. Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, Sterling, Henry Owens, and myself started the program Stop Dope Now.
Okay.
Did he talk about
yes,
that?
He did.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we started that program, the three of us. And we traveled all over the South and Michigan, looking at programs and looking at some of the things that some of the other people were trying to do to combat drug addiction. And we were fortunate enough to get a grant from the National Institute of Health for $1 million.
Wow, he didn't mention that.
Oh, he didn't?
No.
Yes. And we started the program, and we, in fact, began to hire staff and everything. And it was interesting because that was in the 70s, and I guess 20 some years later, I met two or three young ladies who said to me that we had given them their first job.
Hmm.
And they thanked me and thanked us for having done what we've done, because they were now working for the city. And they said, we had not gotten that exposure or that experience working with Stop Dope Now, you know, they wouldn't be in the job that they were in now. Mm-hmm. So we got the money, but, we did quite a bit, but we were young and inexperienced. We didn't misuse the money, but we got misused in the process, because the National Institute of Mental Health wouldn't give it to us, okay? Directly, they let the Urban League be the conduit. Mm-hmm. And we had to get the money from them.
Right.
And they got a percentage for being the conduit, right? Okay. Yeah, right. So, being the age we were in, our late 20s, we were prone to mistakes, but they were not mistakes connected with fraud or misuse of funds or anything like that, because every quarter we had to file a report, mm-hmm. and we did so,
right.
Okay? So there was never a problem there. And
was that part of your job, or were you doing that as a volunteer?
No, we did that as a volunteer. Yeah. We did that on our own,
yeah.
Right. And what happened was is that the program that dealt with the young black males that were dropouts, that particular program where Henry Orange was working, he discovered that quite a few of them were strung out on drugs. Mm. And he came to us and said, well, we got to do something, because they tried to do withdrawal with a couple of them in Henry's apartment, because he was a bachelor just like I was. So they just took a couple of them, corralled them, wouldn't let them go out, and,
right.
And did it like that. Right.
Yeah.
Later on, once we got the program up and running and we got a doctor involved, then we started dispensing methadone. And so we were probably the first methadone program in the Southeast. And so we learned quite a bit about drugs. Heroin was the drug of choice for most of them. And so from that, the program was set up, and we established our own board of directors. And, we developed different kinds of programs within Stop Dope Now to help other segments of the community.
Mm-hmm.
So, we would have also a job counseling, okay, because we knew that was one of the biggest things that the community was facing. Not enough young people were working, not enough grown people were working. So we did that. We would have summer job programs where we would have young high school kids going into neighborhoods and cleaning up the streets and different things like that, picking the trash up, and we would pay them with some of those funds that we had. And there were different, let me see, what else did we do? We had a clothes closet, and then we had a counseling center for young men to get them ready to interview for a job.
Wow.
Okay.
A lot.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you ever have staff, or did you?
Yes. Yeah. We had staff,
yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about. Those two young ladies. We had we had about six employees.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. As well as the main secretary.
And where was, and you had offices?
We primarily were staffed in Park Duval. they let us use some offices.
Okay.
After we got the money, they let us use some offices.
In the neighborhood?
In the neighborhood, right.
Mm-hmm. In the neighborhood center?
In the neighborhood center, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. In the neighborhood center.
Okay. So even after you left there to work for HUD, you were still coming back?
Right, yes. Well, I was in graduate school.
All right.
And I was coming back.
You're still doing
it. Yeah, and I was president of the board.
How did you do
that? Well, they elected me. Well, Sterling basically said was that, Beth, I don't have time to do it. You know, why don't you set up the board and let's see if we can get these people on the board. We had one alderman who represented this neighborhood. He was a dentist, still is a dentist. He was on the board, and we had a couple of school teachers. We had a banker, and we basically had people who had a feel for the community and understood what was going on in the community and didn't look down on the community. So, and the board would set policy in terms of what direction Stop Dope Now would go and what they should be doing with the money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Besides what the federal guidelines said that we should be doing, but yeah, they made sure we stayed within those guidelines.
Right. Mm-hmm. How important was it to have people like that, allies and advocates like that?
Oh, it was very important, because unless you have that, then you're gonna have a lot of bickering and a lot of mistrust. And the thing that was so important and so, I guess, good about this whole process was that the money was already there when we crafted the board.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a thing of we got the money, and since we got the money, we ought to be able to say what it's going to go for. No, it wasn't like that. We already had the money. The three of us had gotten the grant, had written the grant, received the funding. The money was already there. When the people came on board, they saw exactly what the money was for, what it was going to be spent for,
right,
what the salaries were,
right,
and all of that. So, you know, and we paid them a stipend to come to board meeting, $25 a meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we only met once a month.
Right.
But,
right,
you know, when you were doing things primarily in drug rehabilitation, you're buying methadone and stuff like that, and you're getting a doctor who is contributing his time, okay, then a lot of money is not spent for material things per se.
Right.
You know, we already had, we maybe bought a couple of typewriters, paper, pencils, you know, things like that. But for the most part, we didn't have to buy desks and chairs and none of that, because it was already at the center.
Right.
So,
right,
we could stretch that money quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We just had to be careful that we didn't misuse
it, right,
you know.
And how long were you able to keep that program running?
That program went about 5 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It went about 5 years. And I think after about 3 years, I resigned from the board, and I was being overwhelmed in my new job because it required a lot of travel.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go all over the state to investigate complaints, so I didn't have the time.
Right.
And I would relinquish, you know, my responsibility as chairman of the board, and somebody else took over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all I wanted Sterling them to do, and they did it, was to make sure that they accounted for the money and did not misuse it, you know, because my name was on the thing,
right,
too. that we
right,
signed, you understand what I'm saying? So,
right,
but it worked out well. It really worked out well. And it's something that I probably want to do now. Sterling and I have had some conversations, Henry Owens. You know, we're looking at something that we can do to help young black males because of the fact that, you know, they're dropping out of school in large numbers, and then they are not doing a lot of things that I think they're capable of doing if they have the right assistance in terms of somebody guiding them, you know. Some mentors, right, yeah. So that's something that we're looking at coming back together and probably trying to write another grant, you know, because the money is out there. We just have to do the research, you know, and we traveled to Florida. We traveled to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Michigan, you know, just doing the research, finding out who had received grants and what they were doing with the money and how they were doing. And that's what we basically crafted our program after. So
what do you see as the main issues now? I mean, if you're, as you sort of think about what a new organization might look like.
The main issues now.
So dropping out, but.
Yeah. The lack of understanding by young African Americans, the importance of education. The importance of education. And it's a mindset, you know. You know, my wife teaches school and she tells me they don't teach this no more, they don't teach that, and, you know, different other things. But just the idea that, regardless of what they are teaching, because you can probably relate to some of the stuff they taught you in the English literature that they, you're never going to use, you know. You know, and some other things that they taught. So the importance is of the whole educational process is that you learn whatever they are teaching and put it to good use, you know, and to further yourself by going on beyond high school. The other issue I see is the violence of young African American male against other African American males. The fact that they can't seem to coexist for some reason. The least little thing seems to irritate them and upset them to the point that they feel that they have to kill, you know, in order to justify the means to an end. And finally, they need to understand that we got mosquitoes. We need to understand that, they need to understand that there's nothing wrong with education and that everybody's not going to be a basketball or football or a rap star, and that it is okay to be a teacher, a lawyer, a doctor, or a minister, or whatever profession you choose, besides, you know, being in the limelight. And you know, for some reason, if someone told me that 1 in 1,000 make it to the pro ranks, I don't know whether my head would be big enough to think that I would be that one. You understand what I'm saying? I would be saying, my God, well, look at so-and-so, and look at so-and-so, and look how big it is. I better go and do something else. So either they're not listening, or no one's telling them, or they have a false sense of security. But it's really disheartening to think that when you know your chances are very, very limited, and I mean very limited, I would choose another course. Let me just give you an example. I had a cousin who was a terrific track star. I went over to my aunt's house and looked at his trophies, and I said, who? And she said, That's Tony's. I said, I didn't know Tony. And she said, yeah, he's very good at it. So I said, where is Tony? So when Tony came out, I said, Tony, man, I'm proud of you. He said, oh, yeah, that's nothing. I said, so you want to go to college and run track? He said, no. I said, you don't? He said, no. He said, if I can't go and play basketball, I don't want to go. I said, so what are you going to do if you? He said, I'm going to go in the Navy. I said, oh. I said, you mean to tell me, rather than go and run track? And I couldn't convince him otherwise.
Right. So like these are the only choices.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If I can't play basketball, I don't want to go to college.
Right.
I'm going in the Navy. So I could not convince him otherwise, and it was like beating your head against that brick wall, and it was just sad, you know. And that is prevailing thought process of so many young African-American males that unless they can play basketball, they don't want to go to college. And that's, you know, so I think part of that problem is an educational process to get them to understand that there are more choices than just that one or two.
Right.
Yeah.
Very important.
Yes.
So through the years, I'm just thinking after Stop Dev Now, and you went to graduate school.
Right.
Working at HUD. And how did you sort of act on your social convictions, or this, your were you involved in other organizations, or find other ways to
I've always been a person that's always tried to help other people. Right now I'm a member of the Eritrea Development Foundation. You know, that's the country right next to
Ethiopia.
Right. And we have a board of about 8 people, and we are in the process. In fact, last year we raised over $8,000. I was supposed to go, but I didn't. Two of our board members went to Eritrea, and we gave the money to the Catholic Church over there, and they're building a dam. We provide the funds for a foundation to do a small dam in Eritrea. That's something I'm doing now.
Right.
But over the years, I've been involved in demonstrations, assisting people, the homeless. I worked in shelters on my volunteer time. And of course, when I work with Catholic Charities, I, on occasion, me and my wife would take a family, and they would not live with, but they would live somewhere else, but we would provide them with different things like clothing, bedding, and we would pick them up once or twice a week and take them to the store, take them and, you know, show them how to catch the bus, how to do different things like that. So I volunteered, even after I left Catholic Charities, I volunteered and taught 3 courses in the evenings, because they have a lot of the immigrants, refugees come back in the evening because they're working during the day. Okay, so I continued to do that. Let me see. I probably stopped working in 97. Okay, but I'm thinking about going back and doing something with the immigration thing, because the last wave of immigrants we got were Cubans. Okay, right. Yeah, they came to Louisville when I was there with them, because Previous to that, it had been the Vietnamese, then the Iraqis, then the Bosnians, then the Cubans, and I don't know, and then the Sudanese.
The Sudanese. Right. Is that Somali population?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, sure is, right. Some of the Lost Boys are here.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about doing that, but mostly some of the things that I continue to try to do is to counsel young people and mentor them on an individual basis within the neighborhood.
Right.
Now, one or two of the things that have really made me feel like I have done something worthwhile is that the kids in the neighborhood, when we first moved here 33 years ago, I've been here 33 years, and one reason that I'm still here is because most of the people who are professionals move out into suburbia.
Right.
And that's part of the problem that we're facing with kids not having a role model. Now, when I first came to this neighborhood, there were at least 8 to 10 young boys and girls in the neighborhood who had never witnessed a young man going to work on a daily basis in a shirt and tie.
Right.
So they questioned me about who was I and what did I do? Because they were already in the neighborhood when we moved here. And I told them they had three guesses. And at first they said I was an insurance man. And I told them, no, I didn't sell insurance. Then they told me that I was a manager in a department store. Okay. Told them, no, I wasn't managing the department store. And then so they said, well, we give. And I told them exactly what I did because I was working at HUD at the time. But most importantly, what has happened is three of the young men have graduated from college, two of them from Kentucky State, one female from Kentucky State. One is a manager for Target in Chicago. Female is in Atlanta. I don't know what she's doing, but she's doing well. And they have come back to me and my wife and said repeatedly, if it wasn't for you all telling us that we could go to college and that we could make it, they said they wouldn't be where they are today. And that just brings tears to my eyes because there was so little that I did, you know, encouraging them, telling them, sending them money when we could, you know, asking them about their grades. And so, you know, it's quite an impact when you have young adults coming back and telling you, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be where I am today because I never even thought about college. You know, but you told us we could go. And so that has been my primary. And just the other day, it's a young lady, she used to live up here. She has four sons. And for some reason, they gravitated to this house.
And
but what happened was they would come and they were always hungry and we would feed them and we would talk to them and everything. And one of them's name was Charlie. And so I told Charlie, I said, Charlie, you know, one thing I will not do, I will not let you come around me unless you tie your shoes. And Charlie says, but I don't know how. And Charlie was like 5 years old. I said, you don't know how? He said, no. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, I'm going to show you. I showed Charlie one time. He tied them right then and there. So Charlie has gone on. He's 11 now, and his brother Deontay is at my wife's school. And he got in some trouble the other day, and they brought him to my wife, and she said, I know he's not doing what. So right. Yesterday he was over, because school was out, and he was over yesterday, and we had a hard-to-hard talk. And I said, where is your brother Charlie? And he said, Charlie is in Kennedy. Well, Kennedy is the school for all the bad kids. I said, you mean Charlie's in Kennedy? He said, yes. I said, well, when you go home, you tell Charlie he better come and see me. He said, okay, Mr. Melvin, I'm gonna tell him. I said, and don't let me hear that you've been in any more trouble at school. He said, I won't. So my wife said, that was just his first time. I said, and when you're in school, you have to do what the teachers tell you to do. I said, there's no reason. He said, yes, sir, I know. I'm not gonna get in no more trouble. So those are the kind of things that I continue to do or try to do, you know, just based on the fact that I feel like I'm here to help people, to help somebody. And I continue to do that. And next year I hope to go to Africa, to Eritrea. Though I'm kind of fearful at my age to travel to that part of Africa because I don't want to catch any diseases. That's what I'm most fearful of, because my two friends that went, that's on the board, one of them worked with me at HUD. He's also retired, and he said that he had gone to UL Clinic and gotten some medication and everything, but he said that if it wasn't for those diarrhea pills that he had, he'd be in terrible. Yeah, that's what he said. And he said when he left, then he took them and gave them to his friend that was left, you know.
Oh, you should go though if you get the chance.
Oh, yes. Well, I've been to Senegal.
Oh, you have?
Yes. And I went there when I was in the military.
Right.
And I got a chance to go all of Europe and Denmark and Senegal because I was in top secret, and I got a chance to fly and do different things and go in places. Only place I couldn't go was Berlin, because the wall was still up and they didn't want us to go, you know, but other than that. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like so much of your work, or so much of the way you look at change, I mean, it's person to person.
Well, person to person, but also groups. I've done quite a bit with groups, and you know, I thought you were gonna ask me about my civil rights in terms of demonstrations and things. Well, that tone was set when I was at Kentucky State. And my English literature teacher, Mrs. Holmes, lived in Frankfurt, and there was a restaurant called the White Swan. And she said that they needed to integrate, and that blacks needed to have that opportunity to go and eat and sit down. And she said, we're going to start demonstrating next week. She said, anyone that's not on that line cannot pass this course.
Oh, no, really?
This was your English literature. Right, that was my sophomore year at Kentucky State. And she says, anybody who is not on that line out there demonstrating cannot pass this course. Well, this was back in...
Now, is this a black woman or a white woman?
Black woman. Black woman. Right, yeah. And this was in 1962. Mm-hmm. This was in 62. And so the tone was set for me at that point in time, because in reality, I had not demonstrated, had not been out on the front line, and was fearful. But once I got out there and, you know, nothing happened to me and I was okay, you know, then, you know, I was like, okay, you saw me, Dr. Holmes. You know, when is our next, you know, when we have to go again? So,
you're ready to go again.
Yes, yeah. I'm ready to go now. Well, it wasn't the nightmare that I thought it was going to be, because you got to understand that, you know, the demonstration that happened in North Carolina A&T, you know, in Greensboro.
Right.
And I had seen that, you know. And so I said, well, it's not so bad, but it did get a little rough later on. And then later when I came to Louisville in 67, I participated in the demonstrations here, you know. So when they were demonstrating for public accommodations. And I basically have been involved in some form of the civil rights movement ever since 1962.
Mm-hmm.
So
Do you see it as the same movement has continued?
No, I don't. It was for a different reason, different purpose back then. Now the issues are different, because when we were demonstrating here in public accommodations, it was primarily because blacks were not allowed to go into department stores and try on hats and try on clothes and stuff like that, nor could they go to some of the restaurants and sit down and eat. So when I came here, that was basically what, mm-hmm. you know, the issues were. But now, the issues are altogether different. And they are much more subtle in the sense that, you know, I grew up in Virginia, and I grew up where I can remember it was said white only, black only, you know, the water fountains and that kind of thing. So those things don't exist anymore. You know, riding in the back of the bus. I'm of that era, that generation where you had to go to the back of the bus. but I think what's happening now is more economic. It is more a matter of being educated and getting the job based on your education, and we're not preparing ourselves to do that, though that was what we were trying to do when we were demonstrating in the 60s. For the people that are now able to do that, to go and get an education, they're not taking advantage of it. And that just hurts me so, because the demonstration was quite brutal, you know, and I wasn't at Selma doing that demonstration, but I had some friends that went, you know, from here. So I know that all of those things now have a bearing on what's happening today, but I think things have opened up and a few African Americans have taken advantage of it, but a lot more could have had they been prepared. Mm-hmm. See, we were prepared for, because we were in all black schools, and the teacher said, one day it's going to come, you got to be ready. And so they prepared us, and we listened, you know. And probably because opportunity didn't exist, we knew that they were going to be limited when they did come, but we had to take those opportunities, right? We had to seize the time. We couldn't go into basketball. Basketball wasn't a big thing. Baseball was probably the biggest thing, and quite a few of us went into baseball, you know. And you know, I have three brothers. We grew up playing baseball. My father wanted us to play baseball, mm-hmm. but we were, you know, all around. We played football, basketball, ran track, played tennis. But he would have liked to, because baseball was the, but we could have, because I played tennis at Kentucky State, Because I was in that group of black tennis players that came out of Virginia. I don't know if you ever, Arthur Ashe in that group. Yes, okay. So, you know, I've been playing tennis ever since I was 9 or 10 years old. So I got an opportunity to play at Kentucky State. The other thing is that while my father wanted us to play baseball, we were probably better basketball and football players. Okay, but and good baseball players, don't get them, but baseball wasn't something that we really wanted to be, okay? And so it wasn't available as it is now for the kids. You know, basketball, football, track, and tennis, and golf is available, all of those sports, you know. So why would you limit yourself to just one, you know, that kind of thing.
But did, so. And did your family really stress education, though, that you would?
Oh, yes, yes, oh, yes, stress education. And we were, I guess you might say, middle class on the cuffs, but not middle class in terms of what a white family would have been middle class. We were middle class black because my father worked for the railroad.
Right.
And so he had a good job. Mm-hmm. Then when he left the railroad, he went to Veterans Administration, okay? So he, you know, he wasn't making what the man, the white that was next to him making, but he was making more than the average black.
Civil
right, yes, right. Right. Right, yes, that's right. So education, and unlike a lot of kids today, even though they know they don't have the money to go, and my father knew he didn't have the money to send all of us, but from the moment that we were small, that's all he talked about, mm-hmm. us going to college. We were going to college,
right.
Somewhere. We were going, you know. And he always stresses, it doesn't matter where you go as long as you get the degree. You know, and I was saying, oh, but I want to go to Hampton, I want to go to Howard, I want to go. He said, as long as you get that degree. And he said, and the first thing you do, whatever state or city or wherever you are, try it out in that state. If it's no good in that state, then you can't take it nowhere else. But it was stress. Education was stress, not only in my household, but all of the families that grew up with me. In fact, in my graduating class of 160 some in my graduating class, which was all black high school, 85% of them went to college.
Really?
That's 1959. 85% of them went to college because we were ready. Mm-hmm. They had trained us and we were. And boom, we went.
What town is that? In Virginia?
Roanoke.
Roanoke.
Mm-hmm. Roanoke, Virginia.
That's incredible.
Yes. Yes. And I would gonna to say, I haven't, you know, and I've been back to class reunions, but I haven't taken the survey, but I would gonna to say at least 50% of them, of those 85 graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the people that I see them, you know, they retired from being a principal, retired from being a lawyer, retired from, you know, working for the government, some retired from police departments, you know, different
right.
things like that. So.
But it sounds like it was that community.
Right, yes, right. It was that community. It certainly was. And they stressed education. Education was highly stressed. And the teachers at the high school, there was only one high school, one junior high, four elementary schools. And the teachers stressed education. And they were well educated because most of them, I think, practically all of them had their masters, and a lot of them would come way out here to go to Indiana. That's how I knew about Indiana, you know, from talking to some of them. In fact, my one of my biology teachers, because there was three guys that taught biology, one of my biology teachers had a pharmacy degree from the University of Cincinnati. You know, and I'm like, Mr. Giddings, why aren't you a pharmacist? And he said, well, you know, Mrs. Bethel, would you hire me? And I said, well, sure, I'd hire you. He said, but do you think the man down at so-and-so and so-and-so will hire me? Then I thought for a moment. I said, well, he said, well, does that answer your question? I said, yeah, it answers my question. And so, and I was like, how was it at the university? He said, oh, University of Cincinnati is nice, nice school. If you want to go there, go. He said, I would encourage it, you know. So, being from Virginia, I never thought I'd be out here this close to Cincinnati, this close to Indiana, which I visit often, okay, and have visited. Because, you know, U of L plays them in sports and everything. So it was the kind of thing that they stressed education. They stressed education. And they stressed education to the point that they would not let you play sports. I don't care how good you were. If you didn't get the assignment and the teacher went to the football coach and told him, you can't play tonight.
Right.
Or you can't play this evening. You can't, none of that you can do. And they would not let you. And so the emphasis was on education. And they encourage you to read. They encourage you to do research. And they encourage you to do all kinds of different things that would enhance your educational capabilities. So we were in a learning environment, and students who were good students got scholarships.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
So that was an all-black school.
Right.
With very well-educated, qualified black teachers.
Right.
So do you see when school systems become integrated, and you might lose some of those fine black teachers in that environment. Do you see that as a negative,
or well,
potentially?
You know, Dave, when we got textbooks, they've been written in them, because we got them from the white schools, and they were a year or two behind what the white students were getting. But I always favored integration in the public school system, because I felt always that as a nation, unless we can fully integrate, then it's going to be like the third column, which is you got and I lived in France, stayed in France 13 months, and I saw that with the Algerians and the French, that it's always something with the Algerians and the French, and and I'm saying, unless America fully integrates us into its society, then we're going to be like the third column, though we have not ever done that, but I just thought that that would be something that people would begin to think about. So I was always in favor of an integrated society, and us being able to, blacks, to go to the schools, the universities, and just within the mainstream of society. What I think research will show us is that since we have integrated, blacks have not done as well educational-wise. And I don't have any statistics on it, but I would be willing to bet you that some of the forerunners of people who have excelled and done great things came from mostly all black schools. It was never a problem. And if you do any research, it was never a problem for black athletes to go to school and graduate and play sports. I mean, but now they're just going to school to play sports, and when they get out, they can hardly read that sentence.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I mean, they may have taken 60, 80 hours of credit, but not only can they not speak in a good sentence, but they don't quite understand what's happening around them. I mean, you know, how can you go to school every day? You go and just sit in there and waste 1 hour and not assume, I mean, take anything in, you know? So what we are really producing is an athletic factory, a mill. But before, all the guys that I knew that went to all the schools in Virginia and other places, they came out with a degree and they played sports. And they were not dummies, because when they were in school with me or before me or after me, the teachers made them do their work and made sure they could read and write a decent sentence, that they could fill out a job application. You know, I can't quite understand that, you know. There are a few athletes graduating today, you know, 4 and 5 years after they, you know, come out of college, but you haven't heard too many of them graduating within 4 or 5 years, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did, you know. You don't hear them graduating 5 years. What's with that, you know? I just can't quite, it just doesn't ring with me. It's a disconnect with the student and education, when you are supposed to be a student first, then an athlete second. So I would think, Dave, that if you did some research, you'll find that athletes in all black institutions or in institutions where they were in the minority, but they come from black schools, that they did a lot better, okay? Because it was been instilled in them that you've got to, you know. But for some reason, they've been coddled since they were in middle school, and by the time, you know, I just happened, what's his name? I can't think of his name. He plays for the Miami Dolphins. And
not Ricky Williams.
No, not Ricky. But he's a defensive. He's about in his 11th year. And when I was working at economic development for the city of Louisville, his girlfriend's mother worked with me. And one of the stories she told me was that when he signed with Miami, his agent told him, "You got a credit card?" He said, "No, he's American Express. You got this? No, here's this. You got this? Here's this. What do you want?" He said, "Well, I want a car for my uncle, for my sister. I want 2 cars, and then, you know."
Right.
And she said, "You know, he doesn't have a clue." And they're giving him all of this, but he's saying it's too much for him to take in. I said, "Yeah, I guess it is. If you haven't taken anything in before now,
it's
just overwhelming. Yeah, not prepared, yeah. No." And then she said, and then they told him, "Well, you got a bonus, $1.2 million. What do you want to do with that? How do you want?" And said that he really didn't know. And she said, "Now, he's got all this money and his agents are doing anything, everything."
Right.
And I'm like, "Wait, if you're making the money, you ought to be able to control the checkbook." That's Dave, if that's one state of American life I dislike, is that state. Cause it's terrible, you know. You make the money, but somebody else gives it to you, and and you know, you have a credit card, and you know, you spend, you get so much a month, but it goes in an account, and the agent, you know. So I have a real problem with that. And I have a real problem with athletes who are not able to manage their own money. So when the agent says you don't have any more, then what are you going to do, right. You know? Yeah. And you don't know whether you don't have any more.
You
so.
Don't know how long your career's
going right. to last. No, yeah, you sure yeah. don't. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I think education is the key. If Davis, you well know, I don't know whether you eat out a lot or whether you eat, prepare your own meals in North Carolina, but you're gonna find out when you get back that the food prices are going up. We know gasoline is going up.
Oh, yeah.
The heating bills are going up. Clothing is probably staying at the level that it's at right now because so many stores are having sales. But I am willing to bet you within 5 years we're going to see a lot more poverty than we've seen previously. And it's going to come because income is not keeping up with inflation, but more importantly, everything is going up. Mm-hmm. And you know for yourself, if you don't have a job where you make a salary, that it's going to be difficult for you to survive because I just heard Kennedy say this yesterday, they haven't raised the minimum wage in 9 years. Yeah. So we're going to see poverty again, like we've seen before, and we're going to see homelessness. And I really hate homelessness because I work so hard in housing to try to provide housing for low and moderate income people. But you know, part of the problem is people have different priorities. And you know, it's really hard, Dave, when you've been living in public housing and you only have to pay $30 a month.
Right.
See, that's unreal.
Right.
That's really unreal. And then all of a sudden, they demolish the public housing, put you in subsidized housing, put you in some kind of other housing, and now you got to pay $300 or $400.
Right.
So you know, nobody's preparing those people for the reality of life, and that's a harsh reality when you go from $30 to $40 a month to $300 or $400 a month. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that, a lot more of people in poverty, and unless someone like the Democrats get in to start some programs like that, we're going to see a lot of people, a lot of things happening to people that we've never seen before. And I just don't know what the future, you know,
right.
because of the economics, and it is. It is.
So it would really take government intervention.
Definitely government intervention. It's got to be something, because the private sector helps, you know, organization agencies like Catholic Charities and some of the others. But the thing you got to understand is that government has the most money, and government has the most resources that they can assist with the problem. You know, and I don't think all the time it's money, but it's got to be a combination of money and support services,
right.
You know.
Right.
And if you don't have those, you know, you're gonna have problems. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So. So should you wanna end there for
Well, yeah. Unless you got any more questions.
Well, is there anything that you thought I might ask that I didn't ask?
Well, no, I think you've asked a lot of the pertinent questions, and you know, I think you understand that this city, like all major cities, but probably more so this city, was based on a factory economy. Mm-hmm. And as long as they had the factories, things were going great. But now we are moving towards a social service economy, and therefore things are not as good as they used to be, because we did have International Harvester. We still got Ford, we still got GE, but you know, it's just one of those things that when the factories close down or move out of the city or move to Mexico or wherever, then it's difficult for people to have a sustainable income and to make ends meet when you only have social service jobs.
Right.
And I think today, I think was a great day for the city of Louisville, because UPS announced that it's going to expand.
Yeah, I saw that.
Right, yeah. So that should help quite a bit in terms of jobs.
Yeah.
And I think that would help, because unless Ford does something, I think within another year, they're going to cut back.
Mm-hmm. The auto industry.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but I think as it stands, things are just, you know, rolling along. But if we see any abrupt changes in the economy and the interest rate keeps going up, I think we're going to be in for another rough time, some more rough times, not only in this city, but all over the country. Because, you know, the gasoline prices and the heating and oil is affecting everybody. Mm-hmm. So, and that's all I have.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.